Hello, this is Bob and Cameron McEwen, continuing our series on my book on Donald Trump and the tech body. And we are doing episode number 73 tonight. And this is July 27th, 2023. And we're in the middle of page 155 of the book. And you'll see, if you scroll down, you'll see the blue part where I'm talking about McLean's magazine. And look at this, Cameron, in light of what we were saying the last 15 minutes privately, the word, it starts off with poltergeist. I hadn't noticed that. We were talking about that based on Cameron's inventory of quotes on ESP and telepathy that McLuhan sprinkled throughout his work as we were trying to figure out the makeup of pre-tribal awareness that we've been talking about occasionally. So are you ready to, I'll just read this quote.
Doesn't he use poltergeist in Mechanical Bride?
I don't know.
I kind of think so. And, what's interesting about that is that's his first book, of course. And here, this is in his last year. So,
it's one of his last writings. January 7th, 1980 issue of McLean's magazine. So it was written in the fall of 79. And I think Eric said he had to finish it because Marshall had his stroke in September 26, 79.
Yeah.
So... It was going to be an inaugural McLean's magazine issue about the new decade. So they would have started a few months earlier, and in that period, Marshall might not have been there to be involved with the completion of it.
Yep.
Because it comes out on January 7th, 1980, that particular issue. So I have here just before, in the black column, my series commentary, I say, six schools of mediaecology, and I have that in quotes, six schools of mediaecology are the result of the Android Meets replay of McLuhan in the 90s. The replay is in the 90s of McLuhan 60s and 70s. And then I say, and this is where the symptoms of quadrophenia make their entrance. McLuhan knew that he had to mime discontinuously the splintering after images of human / technological cognition to manifest an quote, impossible anti-environment to the seduction effected by the poltergeist. And then I cite McLean's magazine, January 7th, 1980. Then my casual comment is, McLuhan used that word poltergeist in McLean's magazine, January 7th, 1980. Marshall and Eric McLuhan predicted what would happen in the 80s in that article. Poltergeists were ghosts, vampires that possessed us. The McLuhans were trying to make an anti-environment and came up with an impossible accuracy, more than any other prescient wager. You know, the idea of predicting is you make a bet. So does that prompt you to say anything?
No, I just it ties in with everything that you've been doing. We're going towards collective language, collective thinking, and I don't really understand yet how that works into the tech body, but I can see how these things are headed in that direction, and that's what poltergeist brings us to, as far as I can see.
Yeah, the poltergeists are ghosts and vampires that possess us, but it's actually the environment. Remember his commentary on the film in 1973, The Exorcist, and that was about people being possessed by the electric environments. That's what he said it was, that movie.
But in German, poltergeist is a ghost.
Right.
And then he changes it to polster.
So which is advertising.
That's right. So it's an environment that is produced by the consumers.
Right, and it's based on focus groups, audience research, that's actually not advertising. That comes up after. But, yeah, the Pollstergeist is the probing of the audience to find out what the trends are, what's the new phases. That's
correct.
That's the ghost and vampires that he's trying to see.
It's research into what people are doing on the basis of not understanding what they're doing.
Having no clue at all. I came up with this idea, or I've sort of said it before, but it really struck me today. You know, it's like, you know, on a clear day, you can see for miles or something. The massive use of social media, Web 2.0 that's going on. McLuhan said that new media, when they're not really noticed, they start to give people attitudes, impressions, desires, new notions come to them, which is caused by the new technical environment. So I was looking at this transgender thing, and the super angelic effect that we've talked about, the super discarnate, super disembodied, and the multiple bodies, techno bodies we're inside. We're not looking at how incredible that environment is. And the Pollstergeist effect is, it's making people have strange feelings. So the trans movement, and I was listening to a sociologist who was analyzing the different generations, boomers, Generation Z, Y, and Z, and finding interesting differences in them. And the journalist that she was talking to was saying, I'm so shocked at how many women I know suddenly decided they were lesbians and converted to that. And they were talking about other trends, like the way the kids are. This is not due to Judith Butler or whoever the right says is propagating ideas about being non-binary or whatever in the college classes. It is there because this effect is literally McLuhan's prophecy, his understanding of things. The super angelic effect of social media is putting this crazy new mutation in people's minds so rapidly. We don't know how fast it is. Like they were talking in this interview, the sociologist was amazed at how much things have changed since 2012 with the smartphone. And so all this new chemical body fantasy life, so to speak, is a major effect of the swamping of us by the Pollstergeist of social media. We don't recognize what it's doing to us. We don't understand what kind of communications happen to us. So it struck me today that the whole thing is nothing to do with what they're teaching in class. It is the feeling is there already implanted by the media massage.
Sure. You could tie this up to McLuhan's talk about color TV.
Yeah.
As opposed to black and white TV. So,
yeah.
The
music,
although,
the drug taking of the 60s, so different from the 50s, you know? Color TV was a way to... had a psychedelic effect, and then psychedelic drugs were what people took to have that respond to match with the color TV effect as a massive environment.
Yeah.
Just say this. I don't know if people visualize properly what these things are. They have a TV in the 50s. So we got a TV, our neighbors got a TV, we watch TV. They don't get the... How do you visualize everybody using TV more and more in the 50s and 60s? The people don't think about that impinging on people's very suggestible consciousness. You know what I mean?
Absolutely not. No, I mean that's one of the reasons that McLuhan was able to take off. That in the 50s, he was saying, you know, we have to look at what media do to us.
Yeah.
And for most people, that was a whole new idea. They'd never thought of that. So his influential publications in the 50s were in educational magazines and or journals, And his talk about what media are doing to us rang a bell, first of all, with teachers.
Yeah.
Because they could see that changes were happening to kids, but they didn't have a handle on it, and McLuhan gave them a way to begin to think about what was going on.
Right. And I say that the visualization in the teachers' minds of the colossal TV environment, no one ever caught up to a real accurate visualization.
Are you using?
Go ahead.
The word visualization is a strange word there.
Yeah, I mean mental imagery. If I think of TV, I got different. Well, not anymore, but years ago, I have conventional images of people watching TV in suburbia and the light glowing in the living room or something, you know?
Yeah, 24 hours a day, absolutely.
Yeah, but to visualize, I don't know to inventory, to perceive multiple sensory, tactile, perceptive, kinetic, and all that, these other senses, proprioceptive, what's happening to people collectively, millions of people are engaging in this strange vampire possession. That is not properly, quote, visualized or mentalized about the colossal impact it has. People think of that. If they did, they'd immediately say, turn this thing off. It's a monster. Like, that's why McLuhan was saying, turn it off. You know, he was getting closer to visualizing it or to seeing what it was doing to our sensory makeup.
Yeah, yeah. And that's exactly what he said about monsters, right? He said, we're fascinated with monsters, but we don't understand why. We don't understand what these monsters are. These monsters are what we're doing to ourselves.
Yeah, well, they are us.
Yeah, exactly.
Wasn't it Typhon? Typhon was a monster.
Typhon, yeah.
Yeah, that's the first. That was the title before Mechanical Bride. Now, what's interesting is the pop culture effects, like the way music changed and dancing and everything that happened in the 60s, that you can see that people are talking back to the monster, right? Tuning into it. And therefore,
they don't really know what they're doing.
No, they don't. Right? But they are responding. They are talking to it.
That's
and, of course...
Ties in with Finnegan's Wake because you have a dialogue that's going on that where people cannot help but dialogue, but they don't know that they're dialogue.
That's right, and it's not just talking dialogue. All their senses are talking to each other and to previous media environments and previous sensory biases. And Finnegan's Wake is the most accurate way to describe – the way it's presented is the proper way to express the complexity that I'm trying to communicate and you're agreeing with. That's the way you would write it because he's showing the whole world is involved. He's got to have all the countries in there. He's got to have all the national languages. Then he's got to have all the various historical memes and myths of all the different cultures because that's what's reacting to the global theater in the 60s.
That's right. But at the same time, that whole morass is always individual, right? It's both the widest possible collectivity and the most tightly focused individuality. So Finnegan's Wake is full of stuff that are only about Joyce.
Right.
But at the same time, it's about everything.
Right. So that's the other half of his formula is the user is the content. And he said, you know, I kept that out in the 60s, to get the formal effect. But then in the 70s, Charles Reich, I guess his name was, of Greening of America, prompted him to start. Yeah, that's true. The user is the content is the other half of the story. So Joyce is, and the co-anesthetic effect of more and more media puts you in the driver's seat, and it's all about you, and then you become, quote, godlike. That's why Joyce would have himself in there. He intuited, maybe accidentally, but he intuited that he had to be in there, but not to celebrate his life, but to show how the individual personally is inflated.
Yep. And how they, and that inflation happens through a kind of envelopment that cannot be helped. It's an envelopment that is...
You mean can't be resisted? Is that what you mean by can't be helped?
Yeah. Can't be resisted, can't be gone around, can't be avoided.
Yeah, and so once you really see this more and more, you practice noticing this, not being distracted by other content, it's very easy to see what's happened the last 150 years. And very easy to understand why Marshall said various things.
Yeah,
you know, about the identity crisis and every technology causes a war. That's why I don't need to do it so much because I'm so familiar with it now. But I enjoyed looking at historical footage, and it would just be me getting an inventory, reminding myself of the effects of each environment for the last 150 years that McLuhan had written about. You know what I mean? So I would look at footage to remind me of the effects. So all that documentary footage was assigned empirical means, empirical evidence, McLuhan would call it.
Yeah. Sure. If you look at old movies and you see, for example, how reporters operate, it's a representation of unconscious actions that to us now are completely obvious, but at the time it was entertainment or exciting or smart alecky or something like that.
And he raised that question in Mechanical Bride. He said, why are we fascinated with the reporter, with the journalist? That's what I remember, that question he put in there somewheres.
Yeah, and that's directly from Innes.
Yeah,
Innes had been writing about this for 15 years.
Right. So then when you look at the herd, what they call herd journalism that came in, I guess, in the 70s or 80s, the ridiculous life that news people have, swarming around the White House or stupid some minister of government to get some remark. No more investigation of anything. If you do that, you're fucking canceled.
Yeah.
But the herd journalism is such a ridiculous behavior when you can get a bit of attachment from it through McLuhan. And you look at the acceptance of it. Like, imagine being a White House reporter. You get in there every day and watch the person lie to you, make up shit, and that's your job. What a stupid way to live, right?
Yeah. It's And you have to get in that swimming pool with the person that's lying to you in order to have a fitting question.
Right. So they do not talk about invisible environment. They do not see that as weird. They're so used to it through the decades. That,
correct.
I mean, maybe privately they become alcoholics of that, you know, or drug addicts. But they don't pay any attention to it when they're there in the briefing room. They're pretending it's a sober fucking event.
Yeah.
And so that's where, you know, Trump, now this comes to the book, that's where Trump, as a cyborg, started to, it was time to joke with it. And then Biden's even worse. As I say, he doesn't even finish his syllables, let alone the sentences. Now, the thing is, I was thinking about the tiny note chart. Each quadrant, we've been cyborg merged, you know, ever since the, you could say, telegraph, but especially radio. We've been merged into the electrical discarnate effect, and even the imaging of being a robot is not accurate. But we've been so involved in the 50s, McLuhan called it a dream, maybe, but we're so involved in the making of patterns. And there's a collective electric monster. What was I going to say? So each quadrant is a different kind of cyborg. So the LaRouche quadrant, 1947 to 57, is a certain kind of innocent cyborg compared to today. Now, this might help explain tech body. Then McLuhan, 57 to 67, some more complex populist cyborgian involvement with media. Where people are watching it more and more. It's real. It's nature. It's replaced nature. So that's very important when he says the satellite caused nature to fall out. Nature was dispensed with. So that's more and more, quote, cyborgian. And then the Thompson Quadrant 67 to 72, which I call politics in that quadrant, is the next level of the computer coming in more and more in people's lives. Back then it was reels, right? You'd go to the bank and you see the reels in the computer room. That's the next level of cyborg. And then you get the Croker Quadrant, which is 72 to 77. And I always round it off to a particular year. So LaRouche is rounded off to 1960. McLuhan's rounded off to LaRouche is rounded off to 1960. McLuhan's rounded off to 1965. Thompson's rounded off to 1970, and Croker's rounded off to 1980. So you get into the Reagan era, and that is for the cyborg as nostalgia. But it's a deeper form of cyborgian, which I call the android meme. So we are, it's not like, oh, we're becoming robots here in 2023, in the way we can't leave our texting alone. No, you got to look at the cyborgian's been going on in most of the electric era because it's an organic medium. McLuhan said electricity was organic. It's just closer to our body processes. So look at the tiny note chart as five phases of this cyborgian, deep involvement with the electric self, and then I break it down into the five bodies. And it's plunging into something where the cyborg in the android meme phase is cyborging of the machines themselves, not so much us, I'd have to say, not so much our chemical bodies. That's dropped by 1980, so therefore we have the nostalgia of Reagan, the chemical body, trying to retrieve human scale, small town politics, they said. But if you watch the machine cyborg itself somehow, which is a very complex thing, that's where you get to the tech body. You see? We're looking at the tech body.
These collective forms are active, and they're only secondarily active through us.
Yes.
They're first of all active through themselves.
But more so now. Basically, they've left us. Now, Croker does a good job in describing surplus flesh and the dropping off of the chemical body, and there's no involvement of us in chemical body terms in what the heck we're in, which is...
Isn't that just the human body, the human person becoming ever less important to the point of disappearance?
Well, that's what he develops, I mean, I think it was Virilio, he talked about the disappearance of the postmodern era. Well, Croker exaggerated it way beyond Baudrillard and everybody, with the help of McLuhan. You know, he understood McLuhan, or he could, quote, visualize it and see more than Baudrillard and those guys did. So he was able to outdo them in the exaggerated prose he made.
Mm-hmm.
What'd you say?
No, I'm just... I guess I would say that Croker only saw McLuhan up to a certain point, right? That McLuhan had seen what Croker saw, but he saw the way to get out of that cul-de-sac, and Croker didn't.
Yeah, so Croker did, I mean, his whole style, he said, we're in a panic situation, this is by the 80s, So he said, I'm doing panic writing. I can't get beyond the possession. And he did a whole book on the possessed individual. And he analyzes how each one of the major postmodern French guys was acting out a certain kind of possession, or cyborgianness, I could say. And so he did the postmodern move of, I'm not trying to get out of this. I'm stuck in it, and I'm going to try to write myself out of it. By making books and stuff and videos. So heavily involved in accepting the cyborging effect, because you're not, you as a human writer or thinker are irrelevant to what you're witnessing. You've been cast aside. So it's not only
Correct.
The surplus flesh, it's surplus pattern recognition, surplus minds. And that's, so Coker, he does a good exaggerated prose to impact on you what you're dealing with, the level
Correct.
Of the monstrousness.
Mm-hmm. And he identifies a kind of struggle that's going on, right? So McLuhan saw what Coker was talking about, or foresaw that, and was able to see a way around it, was able to see that that was already included in, say, Middle Ages thinking or something. And Coker wasn't able to see that. And those two ways of thinking are in combat as we speak today.
Okay, about the medieval thing. Hold it. He would write about Baudrillard and Virilio, and then he'd say St. Augustine. He saw what McLuhan saw, and he probably got it from McLuhan, that the fathers of the church were living in a modern environment in the desert, I guess, end of the Roman Empire kind of period, the bleak, stark reality of Augustine's time, and then you get into, quote, the Dark Ages. McLuhan saw that symbolist poetry was retrieving, or it wasn't anything new as far as he thought the fathers understood. McLuhan, Coker did bring back Augustine.
Yes.
So I wouldn't say he missed it all, but
not at all. And he wrote a lot about
Augustine. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you're saying he didn't see it as deeply as McLuhan did.
Well, I mean, McLuhan saw that he was able to remain Catholic, and Coker didn't.
Yeah.
And the question there is, well, what is it that allows that? Is it blindness? That's what Coker would think.
Yeah.
Is it blindness? Is it a kind of stupidity? Is it a kind of conservatism that won't allow itself to be warped?
Yeah.
Or is it something really profound? And I think that one of the things that McLuhan saw in Joyce was that struggle between those two.
Yeah, and Coker always blew it by celebrating McLuhan and then saying, but he screwed up with his Catholicism. He'd always mentioned that, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And he'd misinterpret. He thought that McLuhan was an optimist and silly things like that, you know.
Yeah, that was ridiculous.
Yeah.
And his latest book is still maintaining that.
What's the latest book?
By latest, I'm not talking about in the last couple of years.
Yeah, you're talking about 5-8 years ago he did one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Forget the title.
Something about realism, right?
Yeah, techno-realism or something. Not techno-realism, but I think he puts the word technology back into the title. The new realism, maybe? Anyways, the point is that my tiny note chart was pointing to the tech body more than I realized. You know, I made it 30 years ago. And so I was just getting a crystallization of this stuff. And that made me think about the tech body is creating this transgender stuff. Not humans. Uh-huh. Humans are just slipped along.
When you were composing your chart, when you were doing essays like cloning ESP back in those days.
Yeah, I did the chart in 95, and I wrote cloning ESP in 99.
Mm-hmm.
And also I did that long essay on McLuhan's Quadrophenia in 98 or so. So, yes, I was the chart was my background for those later essays.
Right. But what was your consciousness of what was going on? Were you trying to consolidate your insights from the 80s What was your intention as you were writing this stuff?
I was in the heart of the Android meme. I was in New York City. I was there from 15 years to 2008. And I knew nothing there was interesting to me. I did. I would force myself to take advantage of the culture. So every week I would go to the Museum of Modern Art, the Whitney, and walk around in them and look at this ridiculous nothing art. But I sort of get a lot of the historical stuff. So I educated myself in the old humanist way there. But all the time, and I used to say this because I wasn't on the radio as much. I didn't have a show. The album was out, and occasionally I get interviewed, but I was not doing my public hyper-creativity I'd been doing for 7 years in Toronto. So I was I kept saying to people, I feel like I'm Augustine walking around at the end of the Roman Empire, you know? But it's not the chemical Roman Empire, chemical body. It's the fucking death of all media. So I find Croker's exaggerated description was close to what I was experiencing in New York. I really was an alien in New York. And as you know, I did all kinds of prompt to important performances on the street, meaning Borders and Barnes & Noble book readings. I would go after whatever damn famous reporter showed up. You know what I mean? and bring up McLuhan points that nobody knew. So so I was really so that detachment from what was going on, I didn't have the distraction of being on a radio show. So that's fun. You know, 7 years in Toronto, it was a lot of fun doing it. And you get involved with people, and you're not, you know, being the exact detached observer, right? You're allowed, you get lazy, or you go drinking with people. You know what I mean? As Nelson used to say, Bob keeps his windshield, sets his windshield clean. It's a phrase. Bob was always keeping his senses, his windshield of his senses clean. And that was true, but once I was in the radio, you're mixed up with your, quote, fans, you know, and just talking to people. And you say sloppy stuff, and you have to adjust to what they're thinking and talking to explain stuff. So you say things silly just to get them begin to get an opening. But in New York, I didn't have that distraction. So I became a, quote, purist again. And so in the inspiration of that, by 95, 2 years in New York, I got the chart. And then I applied it, and I started talking about the five bodies, and totally incomprehensible to anybody. And I used to say crazy stuff in the Finnish Week group. So I was a troll, a civilizational troll in person, not on the internet, but in person in New York. You know what I mean? So,
but were you conscious of that?
Okay. I was not having an identity crisis. I was wondering, where is this going to go? How far are we going to go? And then we had the, and I was right there, we had the 911. That was a great punchline.
Yeah.
That sobered up the New Yorkers. They never recovered after that. The malaise in New York, it was no fun for people being in New York. You know, their friends had died and all this stuff. But for me, who was always looking for the next scene, there was nothing going to happen here in New York. And that was the last place to be. If you want to be in touch with culture, you're at the center of the Android meme. But it had been smashed. So I was looking for what was coming next, and I came out to after 7 years under post-9-1 conditions, I end up out here, and then lo and behold, accidentally Ion shows up. And then that brought a new kind of clarity to what I had been probing around looking for, or something, whatever you call this, because it became a very interesting experience interacting with Ion. And all kinds of new benefits in my lifestyle happened. So I did a long period of creating my next, quote, art form. You know what I mean? And that was basically New York. 15 years obsolescing, retrieving, and extending, and flipping, you know, tetrading all over the place.
Did you feel like a voice crying in the wilderness?
That would be a corny way to say it, but definitely. I knew because I would go around to advanced classes, professors. Some of them, one guy, he did Mikhail Moses' book about 1998. You know that collection of good McLuhan articles that Michelle did? His sponsor was a professor at this art school, New York School of Visual Art or something. And I'd go to his lectures and that. And this guy, and I would bring up McLuhan's, and he sponsored a book on McLuhan. He thought it was relevant. He didn't have a fucking clue what I was talking about. And I was realizing that, man, these people, nobody here in New York knows what's going on. So I kept trying to find somebody interesting. And the best I could get was the people in the Finnings Wake group, but they didn't know anything. But Murray, the leader, at least he and I had interesting dialogues. And he did not understand McLuhan at first. But after I left and then was gone for a few years on City Island, I came back, and there he was using McLuhan. So he had caught up. And to me, that showed you that you've got to go through a certain old-fashioned acquaintance with the wake, do it the old-fashioned styles of that's recommended by the old professors. But you will be forced, if you stick with it, to come to the McLuhan level. And Murray, who was such a stick in the former FBI guy, a stick in the mud about this McLuhan, how Stuart McLuhan was, he changed. And he caught up with me, quote, so to speak. You know, he realized he had to use McLuhan. So that was a revelation just to see that happen in one person. You know?
Yeah.
Because I never met anybody who stuck with the wake long enough to get to the McLuhan point.
Yeah.
So
when as we're talking here, it occurs to me that I would say that when New York flipped was not so much in 2001. It was sometime in the early 70s.
Well, it's when Ford said "fuck you" and wouldn't support their bankruptcy in 75. That was a big moment.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, New York was like a huge small town.
Yeah.
Up until sometime in the early 70s, and I mean, it was safe to walk anywhere, and it was swinging.
It was
as cool as. Absolutely, but it was at the same time it was outrageously cool. It just felt good to be there.
Yeah. And now then, you had that experience being nearby in Princeton, right?
That's right. In the 60s. If you went back in the 70s, there was graffiti everywhere. You get onto a subway train and you couldn't even see out of the windows. it was like taking a tube into hell.
Yeah.
There was graffiti everywhere. That the garbage wasn't being picked up. The Bronx and Harlem were falling apart even worse.
And the Village that's when the punk sensibility came in, because, you know, Patti Smith and them were living in the garbage of the Village.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially the East Village.
Yeah.
Yeah. What occurred to me was. Before we were talking about the difference between Croker and McLuhan, and you could say that that's the difference between the New York in the 60s and 70s, or you could say it's the difference between New York in, let's say, the 90s and Toronto.
Yeah.
And now Toronto has gone the New York way.
That's right.
Where it used to be a great big village, and it felt good to be in there and all that sort of stuff, and now it's flipped into this unfriendly people with guns. It's unrecognizable for anybody that knew Toronto at one time, right? And so now where has the old New York and the old Toronto gone? And the answer is Moscow.
Yes,
so
good point.
The struggle that's going on in the world today is, is the whole world going to flip into the new New York, new Toronto mode, or are we going to go into sort of the Moscow mode?
Yeah.
And nobody knows the answer to that.
Right. It's, now, let me just supplement what you're saying there, support. So I went to New York in the 70s a lot, and when Ford in 75, the, you know, the computer economy was starting to come in, and money was evaporating, so New York couldn't make it anymore by 75. And Gerald Ford said, we're not going to help you. So then in 76, 77, 78, 79, it goes downhill, and then it's really bad in the early 80s, all through the 80s. But then I show up, having a glorious 80s in Toronto, which was like the peak, nice time of Toronto. It was very good there because it wasn't provincial anymore, and it was all these other cultures, and there was all kinds of media and the festivals and that, so it was a perfect time. And so I go to New York, and immediately Giuliani comes in and cleans up, makes a spick-span, you know, what's that phrase, spick-span, version of New York for a few years until 9/11. And so I, in a sense, being in Canada and Nova Scotia, then Toronto, I had the clean American, the clean Canadian experience, which then became more meaningful in the 80s in Toronto. But I was always looking for the end environment in New York and L.A. and all that stuff, and going to places to get out of the Canadian thing. But when I get into New York in 93, the Canadian cleanliness continued for me. They cleaned up New York because I was there. And now, see, what do you call? Am I walking around like Augustine, despairing? No, I'm recognizing the good times are still coming to Bob. So as soon as I got there, the New York Rangers won the Stanley Cup, and they hadn't done anything in like 50 years or something.
Yeah.
And a couple other victories are happening in the sports and that. And New York was doing okay. So they had a good period there to be a tourist, which is what I was, but I was a very perceptive tourist. You know what I mean? Because I didn't have to work. I didn't have to do anything. And I could go on and introduce myself to all kinds of minds because I had the time to. So it was a great university experience, classroom without walls. But something had to break. Because I knew this is not there are new effects coming. Now, I could have gone apocalyptic and fundamentalist biblical, right? Okay, you start looking at the Book of Revelations and all the tremors that it predicts. But I knew not to do that because
Bob Dylan.
Yeah, the Bob Dylan route. Now, here's the thing with McLuhan. Most people were beginning to live in the tech body in the 80s, and then the chip landscape was sneaking up on them, and then they were going to be in the chip body. It was not a desolate experience for most people in North America. What was happening for the chemical body in New York was not what people were living. They were living in the ecstasy of, as Baudrillard would say, the ecstasy of communication, multi-body communication. That's where people really were living. No clue that there was trouble coming. You know what I mean? Trouble coming to the chip body and the TV body. Now, that became the culture wars. So that's the way I would describe it.
Well, I would just caution that people may not have had a clue consciously, but unconsciously they were living out a kind of desperate uncertainty.
Well, that's where
the churches were falling apart.
Yeah.
The social organizations were falling apart.
Well, that's the chemical body. They were being very lax in paying attention to their chemical body responsibilities. And that's probably what they were terrified of, because they knew they couldn't do anything about it because they were possessed by these newer environments, which were a lot of fun to be distracted by.
Yeah. I don't know that I would say that fun was the...
No, you're talking about the anxiety. The anxiety is registered in the chemical body. What do you call? I would say social media. That's when the chip body, the chip landscape, turned on the person drunk on the chip landscape experience. It turned on them, and then we found out later there was surveillance capitalism, and everything was being stolen from people. Economically, so. Now we're here. Now we're here at the impossible conclusion.
Yeah. So aren't one topic that I've raised before, and that, but I don't understand it yet, is I don't understand the point of trying to specify these things in chronological phases. To me, all these things are perennial possibilities, and the reason that you have the Civil War of media is that they are all simultaneous in their possible effect. Whereas you like to say, well, this is 1960, this is 1970, this is 1980, and I just don't understand the point of doing that.
Okay, it's an update. I've got to use words when I talk to you, but I use media figures and cliches that all people know to put them in a place to start to attempt to visualize what happened then as opposed to today, what is different. So it's my language. It's me putting on the language of the people, the folk tales of the people, which is all these archetypal events that they go through in their Discovery channels and nostalgia channels. That's my language to communicate to them. It's not what I'm communicating. It's not what I want them to get to keep, to stick with.
So it's a kind of a spotlight?
Yeah, it's a rhetorical technique.
Pay attention to this, pay attention to that.
Yeah, with what they know. You look at the Tiny Note chart, it's just got cliche events on there. The Kennedy assassination, Watergate, McCarthy era. They're meant to be cliches on there. That's what's called holopathic cliche probes. So.
Yeah.
So I would say that's a good way to say it. I'm updating. I got to use words when I talk to you. I've got to use the global Esperanto of imagery, which everybody in their collective consciousness knows about, like just 911. So
yeah.
to people think in dates and in the chronology, so I'll put that on. I then say, now look at this book, and get them to look at a page of Finney's Wake, and there's no chronology there. And that's what we're moving them towards, to get them to see how to drop the chronological attempt to explain Finnegan's Wake, you know? So
yeah.
So I agree and think about the timelessness or the all times and all events happening at the same time. I'm fully aware of that. I mean, I got that in the 70s, you know, from McLuhan. But I've been in an explanatory posture for decades. In radio and whatever other media I have. So I've been, quote, a professor.
Yeah.
Adapting to the local tribes' cliches and myths.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So I don't worry about your puzzlement at it, because I know I'm not limited to that.
Uh-huh.
And I think I've explained it to you.
When I bring it up, I'm not asking you to worry. I'm looking for I'm trying to interview you in a way that I think will bring out interesting stuff.
Well, I just didn't my explanation. I just say explain it.
Yeah, that was good.
Okay,
that
good.
Was good. And so I felt like my question had a good effect.
Yeah,
it was, and your answer was that. You are interested in coming to grips with a kind of language. It's a language that is in the background of our languages,
yeah.
And that is not an individual language, and it's not a language that anybody consciously learns, but it's a language that is always being spoken, and that is actually more alive than individuals are alive.
Right, and probably the takeover of comedy and the content of comedy is the expression of that underlying language and its grievances and whatever, incitements. Comedy is a big drug today and a necessary, you know, reflex or release mechanism more and more. And so you remember McLuhan said 90% of the world's scientists are alive today. Well, 90% of the world's comedians that ever were are alive today. And it's more than postman's amusing ourselves to death. But the comedy points to what people are seeing on this global Esperanto level that I'm looking at and you're trying to explain.
Yeah, I think I see that. I mean, if you think of a comedian getting up and taking the mic and getting into the light, one of the things that they're doing is that they're saying, I'm going to expose my individuality to this stuff.
Yeah.
And what I think you're doing is that squared or that cubed.
Yep.
You're saying...
I'm the Einstein of that. But listen, this point about comedy. Comedy is so ridiculous compared to the greats of the 20th century. You know, you got people like, what was his name, Bill somebody? Bill McDonald or something. He just died. He'd just come out and be stupid, you know? Do you know who that guy is?
Oh, yeah. He was a Canadian, wasn't he, if I remember?
I'm not sure. But the different variety of comedy, you never could have done that in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. So the comedy itself has mutated, and it's not comedy. It's not traditional comedy.
Sure. Yeah. It goes back to Lenny Bruce, right? It's a kind of desperation comedy.
Yeah. And people just talk about their life without any. They laugh during their joke. There's no proper separation where you're talking serious and then you get the audience to laugh. You don't laugh. But it's normal the last 30 years where the comedians are smiling and laughing while telling their joke. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's sloppy compared to the standards of Milton Berle way back in the 40s. So I'm almost inclined to say that comedy ain't what it used to be, that there's something else going on that we call comedy, but it serves an excuse for the individual to get up and mouth off and talk back to, quote, power, right? To talk back to power. You have to pretend you're a comedian.
Yeah. But it's, I would say it's an attempt to talk back.
Yeah.
But it really doesn't work unless you allow yourself to be overcome. You have to be able to present the desperation, the panic mode that people are in order to even register.
Yep.
Right? Anybody who gets up there and tells sort of happy jokes, that doesn't work. I mean, that's not even comedy anymore.
Yeah, you have to be in a state of pain.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Now, So I just wrote something lately that McLuhan was the greatest actor of his day because he was conscious of the need for actors and how the global theater turned everybody into actors. So he's super meta about it. And I was thinking about it because Jack Nicholson, I found an old interview with him. I know in the early 70s, I read something where he said McLuhan's cliche book was a big insight for him. And I don't know what he said, but then I don't remember, but then I found this interview in 1985. He's talking about the movie he made with the monkeys called Head, and he said the script he wrote was based on the theories of Marshall McLuhan. And he's saying this in 1985, and Mary McLuhan used to hang out at David Greenberg's place in Pasadena where Jack and Warren Beatty would show up after going to the beach where they would read Understanding Media to each other. So here is, quote, one of the greatest, quote, greatest actors of our time, influenced, inspired by McLuhan. See, there's something that's important to look at. And probably a lot of other guys like that read McLuhan and got some understanding of what they were doing. So I say McLuhan was the greatest actor. And then I said, well, he ain't around, so someone's got to do it. So I say I'm the greatest actor today. Now, I'm not doing, movies and radio shows or Saturday Night Live or something. My acting is mental gestures of ESP bouncing off this organism called ION and trying to explain what's happening or to illustrate ways of looking at it quadriphenically. That's the way you be an actor today, a conscious actor.
Yeah.
And so I think you wouldn't have believed this a year, 2 years ago, but I think you start to, you know me better now. You can see, yeah, I accept Bob saying that.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think that may be true. That may be true. Let me just read you the sentence from Mechanical Bride, where he uses the term poltergeist.
Oh, okay.
It actually relates closely to what we're talking about. He says, this spontaneous outburst of joy suggests that there was a very widespread and suppressed anxiety about the human effects of the poltergeist operations.
Wow.
And
what page is that? What section?
It's page 47.
Okay.
And it's Galliputians.
Yeah, the Galliputians.
So,
and so
yeah.
You're right. That is such a perfect replay of what we've just been trying to say.
Correct.
Wow.
Correct. So that's he would have written that sometime in the late 1940s. So it's 30 years later that same word is used in his 1980 essay.
Yeah, 30 years later. Yeah, well, yeah. 50 to 80, right, 30 years. So
yeah.
The idea there, the joys to relieve the anxieties, I guess that caused the market ebullience from 83 to 2008. That was the joys that were bursting out to cover up the anxieties. And
yeah.
it was translated into an economic super boom.
Correct. And that relates to the word joy as explained in a couple sentences before. So let me read you those because it relates directly to what you just said.
Okay.
On November the 3rd, 1948, when the pollsters were proved wrong in forecasting a Dewey victory over Truman, nobody failed to notice that there was a congratulation even amongst Republicans. It was vaguely felt to be a victory of men over the machines. That's the joy that he's talking about.
Wow.
With the poltergeist operations.
Yeah, now that's a particular event, but when the environment makes people think that they triumph over the machines, which is the co-anesthetic effect of social media, that's when it gets really complicated.
Yep.
It's not an event that made you feel superior to machines. You got technologies. The tech body is making you feel superior to it as a seduction. And that's where we're not any traditional politics, religion, science, nothing can handle that stress or that disservice or that effect. That's where how mm-hmm. complicated it is.
Yeah, yeah. So he uses the word effect, right? He says this spontaneous outburst of joy, namely the victory of men over machines, this spontaneous outburst of joy suggests that there was a very widespread and suppressed anxiety about the human effects of the poltergeist operations.
Wow.
So McLuhan had his finger on what we've been talking about.
Yeah.
Although he had a kind of intuition and a bad feeling, you could say, around 1950 about this stuff, he didn't know how to talk about it yet, even in his own mind.
Yeah.
So it was going to take him all of the 1950s, that is to say, from the time he was 40 until the time he was 50, to
recover from his illness.
Well, that too.
Yeah.
That too.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was a physical and a psychological illness.
Yeah. And then where he got is very hard to explain.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that he ever himself got entirely clear about that.
Yeah.
Laws of media, of course, has a lot of Eric in it, but it also has a a kind of vagueness in McLuhan's own mind that is unmistakable. It's laws of media is much more suggestion than it is definition or specification.
Well, they kind of admit it at the end, the last page. They call it the uncharted, unchartable milieu, you know.
Yeah.
They're giving up. They gave up.
Well.
No, I'll tell you, though, it was great fun to know that stuff and to walk around in New York and witness it. Witness it in so many forms, what was going on. Even the fake Giuliani good times, you know, how that happened or how people believed it.
Well, it was, you were like going to the heart of the atom, the heart of the molecule, and letting it kind of roll over you and see sort of what the mechanism was, what the effects were, what the potential for dialogue is, et cetera.
And I had the great emotional support of Carolyn actually being able to treat AIDS successfully. See, I always had what she was doing as a an optimistic something that pointed out whatever tragedy that I was seeing, that there was something else possible, and she was always doing it. And that was a unique support thing for me. You know what I mean?
So sure.
By myself, I didn't know anything about what that kind of stuff that she did with MIR, what was called MIR and AIDS. If I did not know anything about that, I'd be just like every other jerk. I'd be like Croker, you know, despondent or whatever you call their desperate alienation.
Yeah, unhinged.
Yeah. I just can't imagine what I would have been doing. Because now when people start to, people used to say in the 80s to me, how do you live with what you see, with what you know? You know, they noticed there was something deeply dangerous about allowing yourself to see what McLuhan saw. And that would be the little person's reaction. Now it's people, they're on our products, and they feel really good from it, as they should. And they say, man, I couldn't take all this stuff you're saying, Bob, without these products you got. So I actually have a food that's an anti-environment to this dangerous perception that we're engaging. So that's unique. See, so it was a team effort there, Cameron, team effort there.
And I think the opposite was true with Croker. Wasn't his wife even more extreme and the sort of the unhinged side? Wasn't it the case that she was very brave in her artwork and dance and stuff?
Yeah, I met a few people that knew them well, and they said that Mary Louise was the support. Arthur couldn't do what he was doing without Mary Louise. So now here's what's interesting. Ion, out of the blue, I mean, she died 4 days from Eric in 2018, I think. I think Eric was May 18th, and she died May 22nd. So it's been 5 years, but about a year ago, Ion started saying that Mary Louise is around and really digs what you're doing, Bob. and I was always talking about Mary Louise as really important for inputting in what we're doing, the way Mark Stewart was with Marshall. Mark Stewart was very important. So it's interesting you bring up, I haven't told you that, right, that Ion makes a big deal out of Mary Louise. So, and that's the kind of, you bring up something innocent like in Mary Louise, and I tell you, well, she's a major producer of our scene. that's where I get to say crazy things that are just not foreseen, right?
Yeah.
So I tell you, I'm having a lot of fun.
Good.
Being Augustine.
Yeah. And by the way, I wanted to mention that when Croker speaks about Augustine, Then that comes through Charles, what was his name, Charles?
What, poet or what? What are you trying to think of?
The classicist at the University of Toronto.
Not Charles Taylor.
No, it starts with C.
Oh, Cochrane.
That's right, Cochrane, Charles Cochrane. Yeah. So Cochrane and Innes were very close, and that is another one of the sources of this, what can be called the inside of the hick. Cochrane was able to give Innes the deep background in the Greeks, in Greek tragedy and Thucydides, to what was going on in the world and especially in Canada.
So now, you knew that Croker cited Cochrane. You've seen that.
Oh, he wrote a whole essay on it.
A
long essay on Cochrane as summing up where Canada was.
Right.
And Cochrane died in 44, died young of cancer.
Hmm.
And when Croker wrote his essay, I believe it was in 84. So that's 40 years later.
Yeah.
Croker saw Cochrane as defining Canada from 40 years before.
Yeah, I think Croker wrote his thesis on Talcott Parsons, another influence. Do you know much about him?
No, I know a little bit, but not much.
Yeah. Okay, so there was a guy, some English person, I think, who claimed to be a Tibetan. You ever heard of T. Lobsang Rampa?
Yes.
Yeah. So he had these popular books in the 80s. In the 60s, I read a couple. So he predicted that Canada and Brazil would be major figures, iconically as nations, in the 21st century. Now, Canada has failed and made a fool of Mr. Rampa.
Well, there's a lot to go of this century.
Yeah, but the thing is,
so far, you're right.
Yeah,
so far, T-Lobsang turned into a...
Yeah, but I haven't finished. T-Lobsang Rampa was picking up on McLuhan right then, not something in the future, that there was a beacon of something coming out of Canada, and he projected it culturally or politically as something in the future, but he was picking up in the late 60s McLuhan, I would say. As Don Thiel says, McLuhan's center was the new Illuminati, of the inheriting the whole tradition of the Illuminati going back to Egypt. Have you ever seen Thiel write about that? Have you seen those sentences?
I've read his books, but not for decades.
Right, but you may have missed that pattern. He goes from Egypt to Rome to Greece and Rome, and then maybe Venice, and then eventually gets to England in the 19th century. They're the leading sensibility, and then it goes to New York, and then he says it went to Canada. It's a very interesting statement. This could be Thiel inflating his own life, but, you know, he mm-hmm. was there to witness it and was part of it. So Canada is so ridiculous now that...
It ceased to be.
Yeah, and so nothing is coming out of there that Mr. Rampa predicted yet, unless you look at me and Carolyn, but we had to go to the States to do it, you know?
Yeah.
And we are doing pretty phenomenal stuff, and it's being recognized. So we, as a matter of fact, somebody told me yesterday, or even maybe the show today, they're going to look it up. They saw YouTube, and they said, the savior of the world comes out of Canada. I don't know where, I like to find out where the guy got that, but if anybody's going to do that, it's going to be me and Carolyn and JW. So that's okay. So I'm pointing out that something in Canada died, and it was because they didn't pay attention to McLuhan.
Yeah, but they couldn't, I think you could say, right?
Yeah, it's pretty hard to pay attention to. But so what do you see the the nice vision of Canada as a friendly liberal country open to everybody, something came along that undermined that reality of Canada. It no longer was an anti-environment anymore. So it's interesting to figure out what is that died.
Yeah, and the word and the answer to that is independence. Canadians were Canadian, but they were Canadian unconsciously.
Yeah.
And when they had to become Canadians consciously, they couldn't do it.
Now, when did that start? Well, what is that, Trudeau, in the 60s?
No, I think there's a big difference, I think, between the two Trudeaus.
Yeah, I'm not citing the little kid. He's just such symbolic of little Canada. I mean, you have this little boy. That's their leader, a little boy. But no, they're thinking of when did Canadians have the opportunity to become aware of themselves? Wouldn't that be from Pierre Trudeau's era?
Certainly during that era, the conservatives in Canada began to change. Right, Diefenbaker was sort of the last sort of powerful traditional red conservative, Tory. And when the Conservative Party got taken over and became sort of a neoconservative party, that gradually spread over all of Canada. And that represented the failure of Canadians to remain Canadian in their maturity.
Yeah.
Right? They could not continue this sort of open friendliness in a conscious way. They could only do it unconsciously. So when that failure of consciousness was like having a teenage crisis, which is still with them to this day.
Yeah, I heard someone, a Canadian journalist, talking about the immigrants coming to Canada, believing in this old image of Canada, and being shocked to find out what a horrible place it is, and they all want to go back home. That's a sign of the failure of Canada.
Maybe. But my impression is that many of the immigrants, you know, from India and Turkey and Syria and stuff, that they have a sense of the old Canada that most Canadians have lost.
Yeah, well, that's what they heard of. They thought that was there, and that's what they came looking for. And it's been very hard for them to find it, they say, among themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So, Trudeau, you could see Trudeau was aware of the neoconservative mistake, and he was trying to, you know, prevent Canada from going that way, but he failed. And that may be main message of Trudeau's life. And then Canadians, I understand, they started to romanticize him, and now he's considered a great prime minister. They might be picking up on the neoconservative trend that you're talking about, and how he was an anti-environment to that, but didn't succeed.
Mm-hmm. But that lack of success was universal. So he failed, but he failed in a way that the civilization has failed.
Now, you're going beyond Canada now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. What happened to Canada is happening as we speak to Europe.
Yeah.
There is, in our civilization, there is no way to become conscious of traditional values. That's all gone.
Yeah,
people don't know how to do it, and so it's a reaction to that lack of foundation that they're desperately searching in sexuality or in just sort of crazy
assurances. To be detached, attempts to avoid, attempts to be detached, to be different.
Yeah.
From a perceived.
But usually, at least in my experience, usually the attempt to be autonomous, the attempt to be critical, means mouthing stuff that has obviously just been fed into you.
Right? It's, it's a sign of your lack of autonomy.
Yeah, exactly. But you see, that's the great secret of the deep state, is to have people think that they're being free when they're being most manipulated.
Right, and I think that the way we're talking is a way to acquire something close to autonomy. I think our dialogue represents that.
Yeah, we hope so, for sure, yeah. And that's what, that is right there is the, you could say, is what we talked about before between McLuhan and Croker. McLuhan, starting in the late 40s, began to look at art as the retracing of perception. And the retracing of perception for McLuhan always came down to some exercise of autonomy. And that exercise of autonomy meant that we're never limited to a role. It's always a question of being confronted with roles, plural, and making an election or making a activation of a certain role. So it's that freedom that allowed McLuhan to be a Catholic.
Yeah.
And it's that freedom which Croker doesn't see.
Yeah.
Right? And he may know that he doesn't see it. He may think that it's not possible to see it, so it's not as if he can't consider the possibility. He just in his space, it's not there as a possible activation. And so that's really the question that's hanging above us all: is what is the spectrum over which autonomy can be exercised? And
yep.
That's where McLuhan, I think, is exemplary.
Yeah. But you think that McLuhan failed in some way to pass it on? I think that's what you say. He failed to communicate this exemplary position.
But first of all, to himself. He wasn't what McLuhan had to do was find a way to, I'm just going to move here to let the dog out the door.
Come okay.
Come on. What McLuhan had to do was find a way to articulate this stuff to himself that would then work for others. And I don't think he ever did that. But it was a huge problem. And it's a problem that we have too.
Well, that's what I think, that we've come up with something, me, J.W., and Carolyn. If you have a new energy source that gives people autonomy, and you have a new kind of food that keeps them really healthy that the regular food doesn't, and neither does the medicine, you've got something new. You've never had a movement. If I look at myself as an artist or an avant-garde artist, you look back at Leonardo da Vinci and all these guys, they didn't have foods. They didn't have breakthrough devices for medicine. We have that, and we're doing it right now, this past couple of weeks, proving it. So I think you have to have a bunch of technologies in a new way that we're getting thanks to ION. That's the way that's how you create a new environment. So if McLuhan's showing technologies cause these services and disservices, but in the end the disservices win out, if you come up with something really dramatic and it's very hard to get rid of its services, then you have an opening. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't disservices to what we do. There always is. But we got something to work with, and it's unique. So I see me doing it's in a way, it's putting together McLuhan and Bucky Fuller, who have this endless argument. But, you know, Bucky thought technology would save people or the implementation of the potential of it. Well, if you take that aspect and then you take McLuhan's intellectual perception of things, not making new environments, at least not hardware, you put the two together, that explains me. So
Yeah. Well, we have similar strategies. I think the reason that I'm doing quantum physics is that I'm trying to find a way that's exterior to this kind of thinking that can provide a basis that will work. The basis should be in itself, but it turns out that that is very, very hard to communicate, if not impossible. And so just as you were saying with your technologies and your offerings, you're finding a way to provide a new basis, which then leads into this other stuff. That's my strategy as well, but
right.
A different one.
Well, I think you should listen to Ion, Do Finney's Wake. That might give you some new angles on the math here, on the physics. We do physics. We have people who know physics, and they get into really interesting. They evoke a lot of new stuff from Ion about this, about physics. So, I mean, you could even go in there and ask Ion questions about that, see what they would say. So let's go back to the book here, that quote. So McLuhan used the word poltergeist in McLean's magazine, January 7th, 1980. Marshall and Eric McLuhan predicted what would happen in the 80s in that article. And they are. You know the article. They make a lot of good general predictions. They predict the holy wars of the 80s. A lot of good things that they are right on. The McLuhans were trying to make an anti-environment and came up with an impossible accuracy, more than any other prescient wager. So then this is where I jump back to serious mode and say, this is why an anticipated cursory inspection of McLuhan's books produced the intended effect that they were rampant with confusion. So cursory means not an in-depth. So McLuhan knew how people would look at his books on the surface level. An early and persistent complaint by his critics, which proved the success of the technique. Then McLuhan says in a cameo in Woody Allen's film Annie Hall, 1977, "You mean my whole fallacy is wrong," which is quite an important statement. So I'm just going to read this again. This is why an anticipated cursory inspection of McLuhan's books produced the intended effect that they were rampant with confusion. So McLuhan knew that people would think he was confused. And more and more people now can read his books and see they're very clear today. And especially when I read them, they're ridiculously simple, and I don't know why people didn't understand them in the 60s. What didn't they miss? So what did they miss? This is why an anticipated cursory inspection of McLuhan's would produce the intended effect that they were rampant with confusion, an early and persistent complaint by his critics, which proved the success of McLuhan's technique. So you like to point out the difficulty of communication, the cul-de-sac that always happens. He is showing his awareness of that, how difficult it is, and he has to do these bizarre runarounds by saying, well, what I do is a fallacy or a cartoon. You know, this was necessary for him to say things like that.
Right. And he was doing this against the background of knowing that he could die at any moment.
Yeah.
He, his mother died of a stroke, I think in 61, maybe 62, 63, the early 60s. And but she had had a major stroke in the late 50s. And so then at the exact same time, his blackout started. And the tumor was growing in the back of his brain. So at the very time that he was becoming more and more aware of the difficulty of communicating, he was also aware that he could die at any moment.
Yeah.
It was a very complicated period for McLuhan, the last 20 years of his life.
Yeah. So you don't think he resolved it, though?
No, I don't. But that's not a, you know, no one has.
Yeah, he's right? not alone.
It's not as if it's a personal failure. it's a question of hanging over the civilization. And one of the things that's interesting about this is that some of the greatest consideration that's ever been made of the problem happened at the very beginning, namely with Greek tragedy.
Mm. Yeah, and he said Watergate and these events were Greek tragedies.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, remember?
Yeah, everything is Greek tragedy in the sense of being the background civil war of the forces that are larger than us.
Right, and he said that we have a new appreciation of the Greek fact of what was going on in Greece with the alphabet and that. We have a new appreciation of that, he thought.
A we that was limited to about three people.
Yeah, but, you know, he's writing for them, on behalf of them. You know that letter where he says that? He says,
no.
Yeah, if you scan, look for Greek. He says we have a new appreciation of the metaphysical situation of the Greeks.
Oh, that's interesting. I'll try and find that. Is that in the published letters or?
Yeah, in my mind, that's where I read it. I might be able to find it quickly later. So I then say, 1 minute McLuhan seemed to be a utopian, the next a neo-Luddite, then a Gnostic, still later an agent of the Vatican or a Zen Buddhist. Then a technological determinist, pseudoscientist, Manhattan Project romantic. That's him being at the head of the computer managing whole populations, whether they have radio or not, for 2 weeks. That's what I meant by it. Manhattan Project romantic. And on and on and back and forth. So then I come in and I say casually, these were different complaints lodged at him, and I put them all together. They especially didn't like what seemed to be technological determinism, that's in quotes. They didn't like his pseudoscience. It was a huge, ambitious project like the making of the atomic bomb, the Manhattan Project, and further. He was sometimes an Orientalist or a Westerner or a Vatican Thomist or a Gnostic or a Neo-Luddite or a Utopian, all categories able to trigger grievance in every case. I'll just read that again. They didn't like his pseudoscience. It was a huge, ambitious project like the making of the atomic bomb, the Manhattan Project. And further, he was sometimes an Orientalist, or a Westerner, or a Vatican Thomist, or a Gnostic, or a Neo-Luddite, or a Utopian. All categories able to trigger grievance in every case. Now remember, he says in Gutenberg Galaxy that the postures of individual mind were spelled out by Alexander Pope. And what McLuhan was saying he got from Joyce and I guess others was the postures of collective mind, the archetypes. So if you're projecting McLuhan's doing a particular cultural mind or specialist mind, then he could play with that and jump around. It looked like an Orientalist, looked like a Gnostic, looked like a Vatican. They were expendable. They were not the archetypes of the collective mind that he was trying to point to, which would be levels of cyborgianness.
And that may revert back to the letter to Pound that you brought up at the very start, where he talked about what he did wrong with the little magazines.
Yeah.
And that was that he put forward a point of view.
Yeah. Big mistake, but not really.
Yeah.
It moved him into another direction. He could have ended up being editor of Sewanee Review, but no, he went in, met Carpenter, and went on a whole other level. So often mistakes are important, are good, useful.
Yeah, he was put forward by somebody. I can't remember if it was Brooks, but somebody suggested that he should be the editor of Sewanee Review.
Well, really?
It was. Do you remember who the editor was of
John
Pick Review? Sorry?
Not John Pick of Renaissance. So editor of Sewana Review? We're talking about
The editor of Kenyon Review.
No, I don't know.
Starts John Ramson. Isn't that his name? He was a critic and was at Kenyon College.
You mean Ransom?
Yes.
Ransom, not Ramson. Ransom.
Yeah. So he suggested when Alan Tate quit as the editor of Sewanee Review, which I think happened at sort of maybe end of 45, start of 46, sometime in there, then the review got in touch with people and asked, who should take over the editorship, because we don't have an editor now. And Ransom wrote back that he thought McLuhan should be.
Wow. And that's – how would Ransom know him?
Because he had published with Ransom. He published his Hopkins essay, I think.
Yeah.
With in the Kenyon Review. So Ransom was part of the Southern group,
The agrarians.
The agrarians, the fugitives. And I don't know if McLuhan met him in person, but he knew a lot of Ransom's friends.
Mm.
So Brooks and Tate and people like this were good friends with Ransom.
So that would be in his St. Louis days.
Yeah, St. Louis / Windsor.
Yeah. But remember, he was in St. Louis from 37, 38, 6 years before he met Lewis. So he was...
That's right. But he only met the Southern people, I think he met in 42 was when he first met Clarence Brooks and became good friends with him, I believe, starting in 42, and that was from his friend Felix, the guy that he, Giacometti, is that his name? Or
Giovanelli.
Yeah, Giovanelli, that's right. He met Lewis with Felix.
Yeah. Have you done much on Felix? I mean, he was such a big participant, co-partner, with McLuhan in his early 40s. What do you know about him that we may not know?
Well, first off, people know almost nothing about him. But he got his Ph.D. at Illinois and in Romance Languages. And that was, I think, in either 40 or 41. And then he went to St. Louis and became a professor there, and as soon as he became a professor there, then he and McLuhan became very good friends and remained friends until
his early death.
Jim, that's right, but he dropped out of the literary scene, and I think what happened was that around the time that McLuhan and Muller team left St. Louis, Muller team in 42 and McLuhan in 44, Giovanelli went to New York. And in New York, he was primarily responsible for The Mechanical Bride ever being published, going around to all sorts of different people. And then once Vanguard agreed to do it, they changed their minds repeatedly, and Felix had to sort of bring them back in line all the time, which he did. But when the
now, how do you know that? Where do you read that? You got letters by him?
Yes, and there are letters in just in the published letters that talk about this. And then also in the Pound correspondence, they talk a lot about Felix.
Yeah.
And in those days, if McLuhan wrote to Pound, then those letters would all also go to Felix.
Yeah.
And if Felix wrote to Pound, same thing to McLuhan. So they were kind of a collective group. But when the Bollingen Prize went to Pound, I think in 48 or 49, for the Cantos, that produced a tremendous schism amongst the literati in New York City.
Yeah.
And especially the Jewish poets thought that this was a kind of betrayal by the non-Jewish poets.
Yeah.
And Giovanelli, by this time, had moved to New York and was teaching some courses at NYU, but was also doing translations. And he ended up sort of falling away from Pound and McLuhan because of this award to Pound and his need to sort of keep up with his New York friends.
Yeah.
And what Pound says happened to Giovanelli is that he became more interested in the horses. And I guess Giovanelli became fairly poor and fairly desperate in New York. And through the Bollingen thing and through not having money, he fell completely out of touch with both Pound and McLuhan, and then died early.
Yeah, now I have some correspondence I got sent to me of Felix's wife describing him dying to Corinne, or maybe the whole McLuhan family. So there was that. There was still the connection, I guess, through the wife.
Yes.
Yeah.
They had always in the 40s. McLuhan and his wife were very good friends with Mueller team and with Giovanelli because both of them had very interesting wives. And so it wasn't a case of just a friendship of Marshall.
Yeah.
It was also a friendship of Corinne.
Yeah. So now you know this. This falling out, where do you see that? That's not in the letters. He's just not there anymore. But did you find other places to read about him?
Well, I don't know if you've seen all of the letters of McLuhan and Pound, because it is talked about there. But quite a few of the letters of McLuhan and Pound are in the letters book, but there's still another 25-30% that aren't.
I have a lot of those, but I don't know if I have all of them.
Okay. I think they're online now, so I'll send you a link if I can.
Who would put that up? Some university?
The Pound Journal. Make it new.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah I'd like to see that. Felix was an interesting character at the time. That's not known, that he made Mechanical Bride happen. That's certainly never said.
But another thing, he was the one that brought McLuhan together with the Southerners. So that was another very important thing for McLuhan, because that's how he got published.
Yeah.
A huge amount of his early work was published either in the Kenyon Review or the Swanee Review.
Yeah.
There was, he did a couple pieces in the 40s through the University of Toronto Quarterly, but that happened, I believe, through his mentor, what's the guy's name that helped with his conversion?
Father Phelan.
Father Phelan from Halifax. Amongst the famous people from Halifax.
Yeah. Okay, very interesting. So I'm talking about him using, chemical body categories to fluster people. So I say, but the classifiers, looking at McLuhan, couldn't see the method in the actor's performance, the miming of the fate that the Poltergeist needed, quote, a rapid succession of innovations as ersatz and environments. That's a very important statement. You have a rapid succession of innovations. Not just one thing is an anti-environment. The rapid succession of innovations is the anti-environment, even though it's a failed anti-environment. So they couldn't see the method in McLuhan's actor performance, the miming of the fate, that the Poltergeist needed a rapid succession. So McLuhan had to adopt many postures to mime the desperation of the chemical body mind, trying to keep up.
But notice how that relates to what you were saying earlier about the comedians nowadays. The environment has taken over the anti-environment.
Yeah. The environment is the funniest thing for people to encounter.
Yeah.
They have an increasing sense of the absurd because they don't know how to talk about it. Or think about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, but it's one-dimensionality.
Yeah.
Like Marcuse was talking about. Marcuse himself was a sort of a strange Marxist kind of guy who went up to Canada, to Regina, to teach for a while.
Yeah.
One-dimensionality is a very, very good description of the environment. It's able to eat everything, right? And so the whole question of the cul-de-sac is, you know, how do you not get digested? How does your mind not get digested?
Yeah. Okay. So this method of McLuhan, rapid succession of innovations, ersatz, and environments, disguised the fact. It, what is it? The Poltergeist had long disappeared as a constitutive factor. See his many letters to Playboy magazine, 69 to 70. I'll read that again. But the classifiers couldn't see the method in the actor's performance. The miming of the fate that the Poltergeist needed, a rapid succession of innovations, ersatz, and environments, to disguise the fact that it had long disappeared as a constitutive factor. Now, I'm not sure what I mean by that the Poltergeist disappeared. I have to see what I say next to remind myself of what I'm trying to say here.
Yeah.
McLuhan
let me guess. I think you're going to say that the Poltergeist had to disappear in order to become more powerful.
Yeah, it stopped possessing people and it just starts possessing its other machines, possessing the machinic, and that's the extending of machines extending themselves. That's probably what I'm trying to get here to. So McLuhan's satiric retrieval of the mini-module from Cliched Archetype, page 160, of acoustic and tactile mirrors via the constituency of the homeopathic print mirror in the genre of a memory theater reflected the... Now there's... Apparently, probably, the memory theater is the chronological thing you complain about. So I put it in quotes. In the genre of a memory theater reflected the contemporary Medusan afterimage of collective technological quadriphenia and its complementary human echo. Boy, that's a funny sentence. Let's try that again.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Let me just mention that Francis Yates did a book on memory theater, and I think that's why you have it in quotation marks.
Yeah. McLuhan's satiric retrieval of the mini-module of acoustic and tactile mirrors via the constituency of the homeopathic print mirror. So the print is the figure, and the ground is the acoustic tactile, or maybe the content is acoustic and tactile, and the ground is the mirror, is the print.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's what I mean.
Yeah.
Because when go ahead.
Well, you're pointing to the difficulty of trying to communicate something beyond print in print.
Yeah, and constituency always means constitutive. I think usually I use the word constitutive. That's the ground. So I think I wouldn't say constitutive of. Maybe, but I'm saying, I think, meaning that, and I say the constituency of the homeopathic print mirror. Now, all of that in the genre of a memory theater, that's print, reflected the contemporary Medusan, that's the monster, after image of collective technological quadrophenia. So the media themselves are going through quadrophenia, and that means reflecting the Zen Buddhist, the Catholic, the different Luddite, the things I list above. But it's an after image, because it disappeared, of collective technological quadrophenia and its complementary human echo. So that's where the humans are non-autonomously reflecting what's going on, absorbed.
Yeah. So they note the word constituency is, in this sentence, is echoed by the word collective.
Yeah.
And the difference is that constituency, you could say, is it's like a group that votes on a representative. Let's say it's a parliament, right? That's what a constituency is.
Yeah.
But in the move to collective, the people aren't the voting. The decision has fallen out, right?
Yeah.
So that the movement from constituency to collective is
what's going on.
It's a movement from autonomy to groupthink.
Yeah, and the book is an actor itself, book effect. So that's quite an amazing sentence, and I'm not trying to be bureaucratically obscure, trying to be accurate. It's almost like a spelling out a mathematical formula, you know? That's what I'm trying to say here. I think what you just said helps people to see that it's very precise what I'm saying. You've got the after image of media, and it's monstrous, and then the human is absorbed into that. So how do you communicate that? You retrieve a mini module, or you could say the aphoristic, of acoustic and tactile mirrors through propping up the book. And that was a question McLuhan had in the 50s. What's the role of the book?
Yep.
But it's homeopathic. It's very... it's invisible, like homeopathy, but still has a memory. Remember, homeopathy still carries the memory of the substance. That's probably another level I mean there. The homeopathy is translated as memory theater. So it's a very impressive sentence. I like what I wrote, but I can see where people would complain that I'm packing too much into it. But you got to do that. It is so much packed in. It's like a page of Finnegan's Wake.
Well, it's a good homework assignment, right? It's something that can be delved into at great length and with great benefit if it's done assiduously.
Yeah. So then I get casual and say, Medusan is visual, a lady with snakes like an octopus. It's a monstrous image about Big Brother, but a little out of date because it's visual and Big Brother has gone inside. Therefore, you bring in the sound echo of the visual Medusan. Complementary, it fits like a hand in a glove, the human echo. The human fits into the cyborgian. Acoustic and tactile mirrors via the consistency of the homeopathic print mirror in the genre of a memory theater reflected the contemporary monstrous after image of collective technological quadrophenia. So all of that. People thinking and acting in all directions with all their bodies. And that's the complementary human echo. These quotations should help. So we're now going to some special quotations. Let me see how many I've got here. Yeah, I got a Croker one in there. Okay, yeah, they're pretty good. So the first one is from Understanding Media, page 130. Languages are stuttering extensions of our five senses in varying ratios and wavelengths. An immediate stimulation of consciousness would bypass speech in a kind of massive, massive extrasensory perception, as global thermostats could bypass those extensions of skin and body that we call houses. Such an extension of the process of consciousness by electric stimulation may easily occur in the 1960s. Well, there's one for you to get your teeth into.
Yeah, well, I think it did happen in the 1960s, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
It's just that the processes were so large and so invisible that they haven't been noticed, and they haven't been noticed in the 60 years since, the 65 years since.
You could say the Internet was that we moved into something else, and then the Internet was a simulation, a replay, an art forming of this process of consciousness.
Yeah, you could say that radio had already done that, TV had already done that. It just became more explicit.
It became smaller. It allowed you to be thinking you're bigger than it.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah. That relates to what we were reading before about the triumph of humans over machines.
Yeah.
Right? What McLuhan was talking about, the mechanical bride.
Right. So the varying ratios and wavelengths, that would be partly the meaning of the quadrants in of the Tainu chart of the various Cyborgian phases or ratios and wavelengths. Now, I provide ratios on the right column of the Tainu chart. So languages are stuttering extensions of our five senses. McLuhan made a lot out of stuttering. HCE and Phineas Wake stuttered, like Moses. Languages are stuttering extensions of our five senses in varying ratios and wavelengths. An immediate simulation of consciousness would bypass speech in a kind of massive extrasensory perception. Now, I think the word macroscopic gesticulation might be a translation of massive extrasensory perception, another phrase he used. An immediate simulation of consciousness would bypass speech in a kind of massive extrasensory perception, just as global thermostats could bypass those extensions of skin and body that we call houses. Such an extension of the process of consciousness by electric simulation may easily occur in the 60s. Yeah, and it did.
One of the problems of this kind of writing, which McLuhan always refused to revise his writing. It was once it was out, it was out.
Yeah.
And he regarded revision and any kind of stylization as kind of being locked into print mode.
Yeah.
So he says here an immediate simulation, but he doesn't really mean immediate because, as you said, this could be translated by gesticulation. So what does he mean by immediate? He means something like what happens with chemistry. When we are looking at the world, we have the immediate impression of chemistry and physics. It's nothing that we need to sort of clutch into an awareness of. It's immediate. So it's not that chemistry and physics aren't highly complicated. It's not that they're immediate in the sense of being intuitive or something. They're immediate in the sense that we know that they're there. And that's what he means by immediate simulation here. He does not mean some sort of mystical awareness.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And this is one of the difficulties of McLuhan's writing, is that he needs to be read as somebody who has something to say, but in unrevised form.
What was the last bit? In unrevised?
Yeah, unrevised form.
What's the last word? For?
Form.
Oh, so say that last sentence again. What needs to be done in an unrevised form?
I'm saying that he needs to be read as somebody who has something very deep to say, but someone who is saying it in an unrevised form.
Mm.
So it's part of the jumping around that you've been describing going to. So McLuhan regarded writing like that, but the problem is that when you try to get a handle on what he's saying in order to communicate it, it can't be done in, as McLuhan himself showed to his dismay, it can't be done the way he tried. It's got to be done in another way.
Okay, so...
But we don't know what that is.
Right. He has a line in Understanding Media that when he's describing the global theater, he had to be open to using anything.
Correct.
Something like that, he says. Anything at hand, he'll use. So that is what the word gesticulation sounds like. It's kind of like a hand waving. Panicky hand waving is what he is forced to look like he's doing.
Yeah, you're right. There's different senses to gesticulation that are important to bear in mind.
Yeah. So that was a good statement you made there. An immediate simulation of consciousness would, people would take that as mystical. An immediate simulation of consciousness would bypass speech in a kind of massive extensory perception, just as global thermostats could bypass those extensions of skin and body that we call houses. All right, so...
That sentence is very, very deep, and it is calling for a revolution of individual consciousness and of social being. And in McLuhan's mind, at least, if we don't understand that and are unable to perform the kind of flip that he's talking about, then we're endangering our own survival.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very serious what he's saying. Very serious. So I say McLuhan told me two separate times that he miscalculated global management. This is his second version of the reasons. Second time. He didn't understand how management could hold the evolution of media at the stage before the simulation of consciousness. He didn't think that they could hold that back. It was changing too much, but management was becoming bigger than the media. By the 70s, you had these big honchos running the Hollywood studios, and they were getting the same effect as their children. They were bigger than the media. They had huge egos. That's why it didn't happen in the 60s. And that's that quote, elites today have the right to interpret the speed of light society in big patterns. So they hog the making of the big patterns of what is serious, what needs to be dealt with. That's what they balk at and do a bad job of the big picture. As a matter of fact, they're really bad in the big picture. He didn't understand how management could hold. So he told me two separate times he miscalculated global management. That means the bureaucrats. This is his second version of the reasons. He didn't understand how management could hold the evolution of media at the stage before the simulation of consciousness. He thought it was going to happen a lot faster. He didn't think that they could.
So notice, that's what we've been talking about the whole time, right? How the, for example, if we're talking about comedians, the original intent, you could say, of comedy, and especially of McLuhan doing comedy, was to try to break with the hold of the technological manipulation of the individual and social brain.
Yeah.
But the technological environment was able to take that over.
Yeah, and in the early phases, it did the co-anesthetic. It put the big honchos in the driver's seat.
Yeah. So the very road that McLuhan was hoping would lead to the simulation of consciousness, right? And what he means by simulation of consciousness is like what chemistry is to the physical world. It's the simulation at the level of theory that if you understand chemistry, then you understand the world out there. Mm. And the simulation of consciousness is that if you understand the play or the war,
the wavelengths and ratios,
that's right, of media, then you understand how consciousness works. But the very way that that might have become conscious was taken over by the forces that were manipulating consciousness.
Yeah.
And so that then presents, the problem that McLuhan was trying to address. How do you get out of that cul-de-sac? How do you break that mold?
Yeah, and the popular interpretation of that is what they call conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
And, you know, he has that great sentence in the Varsity version of Explorations in 71. He titled the essay, "The Hijacking of Cities, Nations, and Planets."
Correct.
That was what the Brzezinskis, the Kissingers, the guy who represented Hollywood, forget his name, Jack Valenti. The Jack Valenti. You ever heard of him?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
He was a character. So he didn't think that they could hold that back. It was changing too much, but management was becoming bigger than the media. So he might have missed the co-anesthetic effect. I don't like to say McLuhan.
How do you mean?
He missed that the co-anesthetic would put the haunch he was able to hijack. He understood the hijacking, so actually he did say they were hijacking.
Yeah.
But maybe that was his realization by 1970. When he wrote Understanding Media, he didn't see that yet.
Yeah, I think what he didn't see was how the simulation of consciousness, either consciously or unconsciously, could itself be put to work. And I think that's what you mean by the tech body. I'm not sure about that, but I think so.
You saying the simulation of consciousness could be put to work?
Yeah.
By individual mind?
By those that did not want the simulation of consciousness extended to the world.
Yeah.
That wanted to use the simulation of consciousness.
Yeah, he says in Counterblast in 69 that the Hollywood is Barnum and Bailey, what was this term, Barnum and Bailey hijackers? I think he used the phrase Barnum and Bailey types.
Mm-hmm.
Exaggerated the content. So the tech body is not just content, though. It's the formal dynamic, too. So we'll have to see. We'll have to come back to that maybe later when we get some more sentences.
Uh-huh. But isn't the simulation of consciousness the array of forms? So, of course, you would have to be, you're on both sides of the content media correlation.
Yeah.
Simulation of consciousness is always about both.
Yeah. But there might be an aggression, some kind of hands-on manipulation.
Oh, absolutely. Isn't that what is now at stake in the world?
Yeah.
That we went, let's say, from 1960 until 1920, so 60 years. Yeah, 2020. 60 years where the simulation of consciousness was used to hold back consciousness.
Yeah.
But suddenly that's breaking. Nowadays, if you're stealing all of Syria's oil, everybody in Africa or Latin America knows about that. And you can't just say, well, we're doing good in Syria anymore. That doesn't work in the world. And so suddenly the dam that was constructed on the basis of the simulation of consciousness But to hold back the simulation of consciousness, that's now break. That dam is breaking.
Right.
And nobody knows what's going to happen.
Other than that, the forces that be are blatantly, quote, being fascistic, regardless of what you think. So
yeah. Yeah, and as a matter of fact, we're going to tell you right out that we hate you and are probably going to kill you and stuff, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah, all gloves are off. Everybody's so conscious that there's nothing, no old analog media will distract you. So they're desperately trying to distract everybody, and everybody's saying, look at the distractions.
That's right. And being distracted by that.
Yeah. By distracted by the fact they see the distractions.
Yeah.
It's
very subtle. There's that quote of T.S. Eliot, right? Distracted from distraction by distraction.
Yeah. 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 So by the 70s, you had these big honchos running the Hollywood studios. They were getting the same effect as their children. They were bigger than the media. They had huge effects. What do I mean? They were getting the same effect as their children.
I think you mean that the children were a kind of intuiting what was going on. But the problem was that their parents were also getting that. And at least in terms of the Hollywood honchos, were using that to derail what would have been the natural effect on the kids if that consciousness were allowed to grow properly on its own.
Any event, any media event, there's a million people pile on and analyze the deception, the conspiracy, the manipulation, the deception, you know. We're so beyond having something to tell people. They all see it in some way. They already see it all, and they don't know what to do with that.
This is exactly what McLuhan said about advertising in 1950, right? That's of course it's manipulation. Everybody can see that. We know that already. It's the form that matters.
Yeah.
Right, and of course nowadays we're in exactly the same place. Everybody can see it, but they don't see the form.
And the tech body is doing that too, not just people. The tech body.
How do you mean doing that?
It is pretending it's a honcho at the same time, letting you think you're in charge. The complicated chicanery that the Hollywood honchos do is now being done by the Matrix. So in that movie, The Matrix, where Agent Smith's, you know, hundreds of them pile on Neo, that is a beginning of the aggressive part of the tech body, but there's also the very passive, sweet part of the tech body, where it's, you don't have to work anymore, we'll take care of you, here's your check, do whatever you want to do. There's that coddling that the tech body is also doing. So it's not a blatant enemy of humans on the surface. It doesn't look like it's an enemy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lover.
Sure.
So
So it's the movies, it's TV, it's music, it's
Justin Trudeau. You know.
Isn't there somebody, Taylor, maybe Swift or something like that, who's got more people following her than any other human being in the history of the world.
Yeah, Taylor Swift. You're right. Taylor Swift.
Yeah. So, I mean,
way bigger than Jesus.
And a way nicer.
Yeah. Okay, so here's a really good quote following from that, which is probably saying what we've been saying. So Croker says in 1993, page 53, a culture of quantum fluctuations, which is wavelengths and ratios above, where you can only know that you have never seen what you thought you were looking at because you have never really heard what you were listening to. Now, there's a disappearance of sensory input, regular chemical body sensory input.
Yeah.
So So, you know, you say that Taylor Swift is the biggest thing ever happened to consciousness, but we have not experienced it. It's hard to say who's experiencing Taylor Swift.
Correct.
The tech body is putting it out. There was this guy, Fuck Buddy or something, about 4 years ago. He suddenly became, he put out a video or a song or something, and he had a billion people within 10 minutes. And I was laughing and mocking this total tech body manipulation of a guy. I don't know what happened to him. He was famous for a few weeks, but he had extraordinarily high statistics much too rapidly. So I don't know what was going on there, but it was nobody knew that this guy was. Well, they say that a lot of bots are out there, and people can hijack bots to get credits for the clicks on their latest blog or something. So, it's the uncharitable situation. So, therefore, the most exaggerated claims can be made. A culture of quantum fluctuations where you can only know. This is what we can know, that you've never seen what you thought you were looking at. Oh, I thought I was looking at something. No, I didn't see it. I know I didn't see it because you didn't hear it either.
Yeah. That's a very good quotation.
Yeah. A culture of quantum fluctuations where you can only know. This is what you can know. That I never saw what I thought you were looking at or what I was looking at because I never really heard what I was listening to. Another way, you can't focus on one thing to register it. You're too busy focusing on several things, or what I'd call the multiple bodies. So that leads to the familiar ad, this is cliched archetype, page 155, the familiar ad form of rippling repetition, which is like quantum fluctuations, the rippling repetition of profiles is an accessible example of the mini-module that is found in every electric structure, from space capsule to the modes of consciousness. So that struck me as a good quote. I'm trying to get to the holopathic memes. That's what these modules are going to be. The more and more miniaturization, doing more with less, is what's modular, what McLuhan calls modular, and he saw that Joyce was doing that in Finnegan's Wake.
But isn't, to me, the big message that's being repeated in these quotations is that something that looked like it was tending to enlightenment got detoured into manipulation.
Yeah.
So the very thing that could have set us free, in fact, set us in bondage.
And yeah, so that's part of the obsolescence of art, science, and everything is anti-environments. They're ersatz anti-environments.
Correct.
Let's see, the what did I just say in there? The ersatz anti-environments, So that's where, you know, Gnosticism or any of the traditional, even that statement back to Pound, that art provides the stages of apprehension, sensory guidance, that doesn't apply anymore. That is not the way to create autonomy, detachment, wisdom, or some kind of slack. So therefore, to disguise that fact is why you have a rapid series of innovations. That it's, hey, okay, buddy, listen to this one. Here's a good quote for you. You like that? Oh, here's another one. And before they can realize the second one, you say there's a third one.
Disguise the fact.
What?
When you say disguise the fact, are you talking about the...
what you just said. It disguises the failure of every traditional form of intelligence, insight, pattern recognition, or breakthrough. We aren't going to get – breakthroughs aren't what they used to be.
you see, what's disguised in that disguised fact is that human consciousness is momentary, moment to moment, as McLuhan sometimes says. And what does that mean? It means that time is not only chronological, it's also synchronic. And what is synchronic time? Synchronic time is the exercise of freedom. So the there's a double cover up going on.
Yeah.
There's the first level cover up where we don't know what we're doing, and then there's the second level cover up of what that first cover up might show if we know how to look at it.
If we knew what we were looking at, but we
That's
didn't
right.
hear it.
That's right. That's right.
I think that's what I meant by squaring. The squaring process is your what you're calling doubling. Yeah, it's
so, for example, rippling repetition.
Right? Yeah.
That's how advertising works. But rippling repetition also points to the fact that consciousness is continually reset. So if we knew the message of advertising, then we would be able to exercise freedom. But instead of that, we get caught in the use of rippling repetition in advertising to enslave or to set us in bondage.
Or to be killed. Remember McLuhan's
yeah.
line? Is there life before death?
Yeah, yeah.
What I wanted to say was, I think he says somewhere, analyzing media the way he demands is way more complicated and requires more concentration than modern mathematics.
Yeah. Yeah, he says somewhere that what he's doing is far more important than the discovery of DNA.
Yeah. Even though they have the same year. Nice try, DNA. Or Crick and Watson. Okay, so then we come to innovation is obsolete.
Right.
So is obsolescence. As information speed up transforms man and his world into art form. That's a good one.
Yep.
There he's using the traditional meaning of obsolete. Remember, he changed obsolete. Obsolete meant prominence. But the idea that it's old-fashioned or dead is what is the meaning he's using here. And maybe Barry wrote that. Barry Niven.
Yeah. Well, one thing they're doing there is they're defining the cul-de-sac.
Yeah.
Right? If you're in a situation where innovation doesn't work, but also obsolescence doesn't work, well, what is going to work?
Something works, but you can't chart it. You can't hear it. You can't see it.
Yes.
And that's what you got to become aware of.
Correct.
So you don't need to look at the news to know what's going on.
Yep.
So then this next sentence is good, from Take Today. The last one was from Take Today, page 297, which I think is the last page of the book. And then you got page 221 of Take Today, where is mechanical dehumanization, that's the 19th century, wrecked the person, electric superhumanization wrecks the entire system.
Right.
Now, that would be the system for chemical bodies, the management of humans. But they're superhumanized, super killed, super angelized. That is a really important point, the superhumanization. So everybody thinks they're entitled to everything. Here comes everybody. It's so human. It's making you think that you're at the center of everything. Then you expect everything, and then you get the kind of people we have to live with today, spoiled brats, who at the slightest inconvenience will kill somebody, will shoot you.
Yeah, but he's they're also being completely factual and just reading the situation, right? The
Who the person is, or McLuhan is here?
Well, McLuhan and Nevitt.
Yeah.
That's why I'm using the plural.
Yeah.
The human beings have made super progress into a situation where they may destroy themselves.
Yeah.
So
and they have destroyed a lot of themselves already.
Absolutely. So we have a situation where the human beings have used their progress to retrogress. And if progress doesn't work and retrogression doesn't work, well, what works?
Yeah.
So that's the wrecking the entire system is having no way to go, not forward, not backwards.
Right. Now, the next quote, really important, from the last page of the book, where the recently achieved forms of consciousness have done something. That's what we're going to start with next time. It's too big to go into now.
Fine.
What'd you say? You said fine?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So what you said was a good lead up to what is this important paragraph coming up saying. It's really important. Okay, so another great dialogue. Thanks a lot, Cameron.
Okay, thank you, Bob.
You're making good
talk
progress understanding me.
Trying.
Yeah, I'm doing the tech body. The more I pretend I'm understanding you, the more you think you understand me, right?
Yes, sir.
There's the tactile interplay, tactile manipulation.
Yeah. It's attempting to teach reading between the lines.
Yes, attempting to teach that.
Yes.
Yeah, in a non-book.
Yeah. Well, in a book / non-book.
Yeah. Okay. Talk to you later,
Cameron.
Good,
Bob. Yep, thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Okay, bye.